probably the wealthiest and most wanted Nazi left alive.
Where is he?
No!
Dustin Hoffman, Laurence Olivier, Roy Scheider, William Devane, Marta Keller.
Is it safe?
Is it safe? Is it safe?
No, it's not safe. It's very dangerous.
Marathon Man, a thriller, rated R.
Welcome back to a brand new episode of Reconcinimation. I'm your host, John Diner.
I'm David Munchak.
I'm Brent Hutchins.
And this is the podcast that takes a look back at some of our favorite films from the 70s, 80s, and 90s. And we're checking out how they hold up here today. And we are going back to a very special time this episode. We're going back to the 1970s, my favorite decade.
John's fave.
Movies.
We're going to spring, being that it's the springtime now, right into our conspiracy month. So all month long, we're going to be looking at 70s conspiracy films. And this week, we are going to start with an episode about the true origin story of David Babe Munchak.
Yep.
And ties to the division. That's right. We're talking about Marathon Man.
Ooh, yeah.
Ooh, I'm winded just thinking about it.
Before we dive too deep into that, I just want to plug upcoming. We have a Q&A episode, a mailbag episode, if you will. So everybody who's listening right now, hit us up on social media. You can, you know, tweet at us, Instagram, direct message us, send us anything you want to know about the movies we've covered, movies in general, movies of present day or yesteryear, either way. We're opening it up to you guys. So we're looking forward to that. And that'll be dropping a little bit down the way here.
Cool. So yeah, send in your submissions. Ask us whatever you like. Our opinions on films, our thoughts of the industry, the business, the things we don't even normally talk about on the show.
What our astrological sign is. Go for it.
No harm in asking. Don't know if we'll get to it, but no harm in asking.
The best movies about pizza?
Yeah, are your favorite pizza movies?
Mystic Pizza. I mean, that's the winner.
That raises to the top, at least.
Yeah,
I'm trying to think of other pizza movies. That might be it.
Well, would you put Ninja Turtles in there? There's a lot of pizza in that.
It's in the discussion.
A lot of pizza.
Yeah,
it's in the discussion.
It's fair.
okay. All right. So, Marathon Man, Brent, tell us what's happening in Marathon Man.
After the shocking murder of his older brother, a New York history student finds himself inexplicably hounded by shadowy government agents on the trail of a Nazi war criminal who is trying to retrieve smuggled diamonds. That's pretty much it, guys.
Wow.
All right. Thank you, Brent. David, take us back to 1976. What is happening when Marathon Man comes out?
Oh, Marathon Man, which is my first time viewing it for this show, so I'm excited to get into it. But back in 76, October 8th, when it came out, Jimmy Carter is the president of the United States and is named Time Person of the Year. The U.S. is draped in American flags as the country celebrates its bicentennial founding. People are enjoying their mood rings and commuting to work almost exclusively in roller skates while grooving to Play That Funky Music and Disco Duck on the radio. David Berkowitz is in the beginning of his serial killings in New York City, which would eventually lead to a total of 6 murders and 7 wounded. Plus, this fall, TV audiences see the debut of The Muppet Show, Alice and Charlie's Angels. And I am sure something interesting is happening in sports, but no one really cares. John, back to you.
Thank you, David. No one cared about sports in 1976.
Who gives a shit?
Yeah.
It's all in the past.
Were there even sports in 76, guys? Come on.
There's one that we do care about, marathon running.
That's right.
Apparently.
Yeah.
That's key.
And long lingering images of Jesse Owens.
Yes, that is true. Yeah. Brent, So wait, John, let me get this right for both you guys. This is a first time watch for both of you.
Shh, spoilers, dude.
Oh
yeah. First time watch.
First time watch.
Wow. That's a first on this show that I'm the only one who's seen the movie.
Is it?
That can't be the first.
True.
That's not the first.
I'm calling shenanigans on that comment.
All right. Well, all right. As far as I can remember, that's.
I think Brett and I shared a few films that were.
It's typically the ones that John earmarks that are like from 1940. Good God, when the fuck was this made?
And it made $4. Not that the box office or profitability is a measure of quality film. So that's not why we do this.
That is very
valid point. I take that back. Megaforce had to be a first time watch for both you guys.
100%. Yeah.
See, there we go.
For sure. I knew there was something recent. This is first time watch for sure. I've known about it forever. At least getting into film school, it was definitely talked about within there. And the thing that always came up, and the reason that I kind of avoided it for as long as I have, is because, anytime anybody talks about it, they really mostly focus on like the kind of torture porn dental scene. And it's like, sounds so like agonizing and painful. And just the whole movie sounded very foreboding. And I was like, I don't really want to I'm sure it's good. I just couldn't bring myself to watch it until something as important as Reconcinimation urged me in that direction.
Yeah, I didn't go to film school, but I've heard of it, and we all love the Hoff from the 70s. So it was always there, but there are certain moments that were parodied in pop culture and referenced throughout, so that I always sort of knew when this movie was coming up. But no, I never got to see it from start to finish until this week.
Nice. Well, I am very excited to hear your thoughts as we get into it. This was a movie I actually discovered on my own. As we've mentioned on the show, summer of 1996, my uncle gave me a crash course in 1970s filmmaking and sat me down and put a pile of laser discs in front of me. And, I went through all the Marathon Man was not one of those. And really, like, it did, Brent, it did come up back at the College of Santa Fe, but we never like watched it in a class. It was never like a required.
No, it wasn't like required viewing at all, you know?
Yeah.
There were other movies from this time, from the paranoia branch of cinema, but like, this was not one that was really needed for any of the classes, but it was referenced a lot.
Yeah, it was. I found, the tape on my own and kind of fell in love with the movie separately from all that. Also, I knew of it since I was a very like young kid, maybe 6 or 7. And I remember my dad telling me about the scene, with both like the Roy Scheider scene with the knife and the dentist scene. It's like, why are you telling me this now?
Brush your teeth, John.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, and I've seen it many times, and I was a little bit, this came up a couple of years ago, and I wanted to do it for the show back in season 2, I think, and I kind of held off, and because at the time, everything with Dustin Hoffman was coming out, and all these terrible stories that seem to be coming out about almost everybody these days, but that doesn't change some of the movies that he has made, whether or not I enjoy them, because as we've talked about, trying to separate the characters from the actors, otherwise there's so many movies that would just be erased, and that's not necessarily fair to the other people who made them and the impact that they had. So anyway, I'm rambling about it, but I was hesitant to get into this one, but now I'm feeling the 70s vibe all over again, and I love the conspiracy, foreboding films from that era. So here we go. What about you guys? Were you, when I brought this one up, were you looking forward to watching it, or were you kind of like, I mean, Brent, you kind of said it already, but
yeah, I was a little like, okay, I guess we're gonna do this movie, and I finally watched it literally last night.
There you go. I was looking forward to watching The Running Man, and then when I you know, searched it to rent it, I was like, oh, right. It's not The Running Man.
Like, it's a spin-off. I would have been totally more down for The Running Man. Just, I'm with David on this.
I'm like, gosh, we'll Schwarzenegger, like, okay. Like, we can... So, I forgot. I just forgot what movie I was looking forward to seeing. But, to be honest, whatever the PR spin and all of that, I forgot Dustin Hoffman did anything unless other than just being difficult on set. Sometimes I don't know what you're talking about. So, I'm just going to leave it at that. I don't even care.
I don't want to get into it, but you can look it up online. It's all out there, but yeah.
He's fine though, right? We don't care. Like the general public doesn't seem to care, right? I think he works less.
I don't know if that's because of that or that's just his, you know, kind of winding down a little bit.
Gotcha. All right. Well, yeah. So because it was Hoff, the Dustin Hoffman in it, I was like, all right, like 70s thriller, let's go. I was prepared. So
yeah. All the it's funny because the 70s thrillers, these paranoid thrillers, like all the big stars like did one.
You know? Right. Yeah.
Like Dustin Hoffman does one, Warren Beatty does one, Robert Redford does one, just go on and on. So they each get their shot at it, but they're all different from each other. So that's what we're gonna look at this month. But
yeah.
All right, so let's get into it. What did you guys think? Brent, we'll start with you. What was your gut reaction when it was over? Do you enjoy it? You have a hard time watching it?
I mean, I enjoyed elements of it. Like, I don't know that I feel like it's a really great movie. I think there are really great scenes. I think Laurence Olivier's performance is phenomenal. Roy Schreider is great. You know, I don't really think Dustin Hoffman is that fantastic in it. And I think he looks really old to be playing like a college student, you know.
He's
that
38.
Was like the initial thing that I noticed is like, dude, this guy looks 50 and he's supposed to be in college. I gave it a little bit of leeway because he was a graduate student. I was like, okay, sure. But I don't know. I feel like there's a lot of holes. I feel like there's a lot of things that are like seeds that are planted that don't really equate to much. And then, but again, like there are scenes in it. Like, I mean, that the torture scene is really, really good. The end scene, I think their kind of standoff at the end, I think is really fantastic. I like the scene with Laurence Olivier walking in the on the street at the end where like the old Jewish lady notices him and like that, like the tension that is like brought on there is fantastic. I even like there's the scene like at the cabin that reminded me for whatever reason a lot of like Untouchables, and I was like, yeah. Oh, nostalgia for a second. But there's a lot of things that just don't really hit for me, you know. Like I don't, you know, he's a Nazi for sure and Dustin Hoffman is Jewish. It seems like there's a thing that can be used there, but like in all reality, like their conflict has nothing to do with him being Jewish or him being a Nazi. As much as I like Roy Scheider's character, like I don't understand what point it really plays in the overall like story. So, I mean, things like that, like, I think the second half is much better than the first half, but like, I think that because the second half has all those like kind of tentpole moments, and the first half was just like, seems like a lot of laying groundwork for things that don't pay off. Like the whole like flashbacks to Dustin Hoffman seeing, you know, his dad and, you know, like the whole McCarthyism stuff, like how does it really relate? Like it doesn't really pay off in the end. So overall, like I get why the movie has had influence, but I think seeing it now and not having seen it in closer to the 70s when we were closer to the whole like paranoia cinema phenomenon, like it just didn't land for me that very solidly.
Yeah, all those are great points, none of which I will argue against. as much as I love the film for different reasons, but I totally see everything that you pointed out, and it's all there. It really is like sort of sequences that are like connected rather than like, you know what I mean? It's all about like these intense scenes that are almost like sequenced apart, that
right,
have a loose connection. But I didn't mind it. But we'll get to my thoughts in a minute. David, what did you think?
Yeah, I'd mirror much of what Brent was saying there, and the disjointed almost first half of the movie, obviously purposely done to that to help create that tension that is going to build. I mean, I get it, but it's, I don't know if each scene necessarily has the full weight that it needs to propel you forward. But I mean, there are certain things. It's like, I think there's like, he's not just like, Babe is, he's not uncomfortable in the beginning of the movie necessarily. He's finding true love or whatever in the beginning of the, but we as viewers have to see all these things happening around him before his life explodes. So that tension, like, it's very effective, and you're supposed to be uncomfortable, and I totally get it. And I don't think that's bad. It's not even a complaint, but it's hard. It was sort of hard to understand that as a first time viewer. Like, I'm sure if I were to watch it again, all of the things, I would just enjoy each. I could live in the moment of each thing and enjoy the performances a little bit better. But I did get a charge almost out of every scene, because there was something to like latch onto. Like, if there's a Nazi around, your goal, punch the Nazi. Like, that's the goal, right? Like, so even that opening sequence where it's just this visceral, brutal, like, road rage incident where I was just like, oh my gosh, like, and it just turned into something. And then you see that Babe was actually running and did see the fire, so he's already connected to it just in that little moment. But he would never know what that car fire was, and
What that triggers too, like, that's going to change his whole life.
Yeah, his whole life changes because of that incident. Yeah. So I think what it's supposed to do, it does it well. I don't know if I necessarily like it just in general, but I don't think it's a quality issue. It might be just a preference issue, in terms of what is being communicated. And then, but it really does come together in that second half. And it was just like, I don't know who to trust, and who's going to die, and how are they going to die, and is he going to get out of this? And I was just rooting for him to just mess up Giselle, like, at the end, just mess, like, just brutal, like, whatever you have to do. Like, he killed your brother, he's this monster, you have him by the sensitive area, so just do what you have to do, man, like, because it seems like he had nothing to lose, you know, but he was still trying to, like, there was still a level of self-preservation for him. So anyway, it was just, once he was brought into the actual story that was going on around him, that's when I, like, okay, I was really on board after that.
Is it safe?
You talking to me?
Is it safe?
What's safe?
I agree. It is a really slow start. Watching it back this time, I haven't seen it in probably 20 years, maybe. And it is, it's like, I mean, it's a long time before we even see Laurence Olivier. Mm-hmm. And it's probably about 45 minutes in before, like, you're really starting to, like, get some kind of rhythm and see where it's going. Cause they did do that on purpose. John Schlesinger, the director, and William Goldman, the screenwriter, who we'll talk about. It feels like three separate stories that it takes a while to even realize how they're even going to connect, that, oh, they're brothers, okay, I get it now, you know, and how Zell kind of ends up playing into it. But it's all these, like, very intense scenes that are like, you almost have to, like, jump, like, leapfrog from one to the next rather than it feeling like one cohesive film. And again, that's all intentional. And they really, it doesn't bother me though, that there's the whole courier situation. Like I don't think you're really clear how that whole thing works. Cause if he's got the diamonds already, like they're in his brother's possession.
Yeah.
What are they what are the couriers doing with it? They're selling them or like for him, or I don't know. I don't understand that.
Yeah. Basically to support his way of living. Right. So like the US government is letting him be in the US. Right. So that he can give them other Nazi war criminals. They're paying him right in diamonds.
Yeah. They're letting him have, they're not paying. Are they paying him in diamonds or those are the diamonds that he's stolen from?
Yeah. So they're letting him get the diamonds. Right. But, but his brother is getting them for what reason? I don't know.
Right.
You know, it's, it's all a little unclear.
Yeah.
And then, you know, like.
And the division too, like what they, I know they wanted to be very vague about it. And I do kind of like that. Like, you know, there's somewhere where the FBI and the CIA won't touch, you know, they do it, but, and they do anything.
Well, right. And it adds this whole like question. I mean, you know, I don't know. Are they as bad as the Nazi guy? Like, I don't know. There's just a lot of questions about like who they are as a US government group. Like, are they good? Are they bad? Like, it's unclear where they fit in the moral spectrum of things. And so, you know, I don't know. Like, it's all very loose and shaky at the beginning. And it doesn't really, I feel like they're setting it up to be, you know, even with the opening shot of like Jesse Owens, like it being like an Aryan versus, you know, non-Aryan or Jewish thing. And like it, none of that plays into it at all. Like it boils down to Zell's paranoia about people stealing his diamonds and him thinking that Babe has information about that. And so like he gets pulled into this whole like clusterfuck of things. And it's like, it's not race, religion, creed, ethnicity, or anything, has nothing to do with it. It's a good like element to show how evil Zell is. And Laurence Olivier plays that off freaking phenomenally. I mean, he's got moments where he's absolutely terrifying, you know, but.
So, but
why?
Yeah. But like, and I am not of the Jewish faith. So, but I get the sense that like, without being explicit, it's like, in the film that like Jesse Owens is looked up to as a hero for defying Hitler, right? To be better than any white or right, the Aryan race, right?
I mean, that's what you'd take from it,
right? Yeah. But then, like, without being so explicit, like, isn't it like I would assume since the Holocaust, it's like every day a Jewish person lives and thrives and does something is in defiance of Hitler and in defiance of the Nazis. So it's just I'm assuming a cultural undercurrent that's just always there every day. There's a successful Jewish businessman in the Diamond District. Like every day that they are better than the people who were put on trains and put in camps. Like,
I mean,
is that the idea? Like it, without having to be explicit, without it's like there are heroes to that. There are inspirations to that. It's a life that New York provides.
And I think as an audience member, like you wouldn't maybe in 76, you wouldn't need to be explicit about it because it's not as far departed from World War II and when those atrocities happened, right?
Yeah.
But as a new viewer watching it now, like,
oh yeah,
you know, like it
you have to do a little work to like if you're not of that heritage and faith, like, oh yeah, right, like you. it's almost the culture of the time,
right?
That and is eroding as you know those generations have you know died off, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think though, as a new viewer watching it, to me, when I'm watching the first part, elements of it feel like they're planting seeds for that to be a much bigger, explicitly focused on element of the film, which it ultimately ends up not being.
It does come back around in the scene that you mentioned where, you know, towards the end of the film, when Zell is walking, you know, is just amongst, just completely surrounded by Jewish people.
100%, but like, it has nothing to do with Babe and Zell.
No, it doesn't. No. That's like his separate sort of storyline, that now he's like in the lion's den, right? Like that he is in the middle of it, trying to blend in when amongst these people that he despises to his core. And you know, and then he gets outed, right? You know, publicly, and then escapes. But
yeah, two different people recognize them. That was so intense. That was such a that whole sequence.
There is a lot of Hitchcockian elements to this film, and that you know that intensity of those scenes. And there's a number of them, the build up and then the tension and then the like explosion of it, you know, in the beginning with the two older gentlemen getting into their racially, you know, not racial, but the, you know, religion fueled argument and car crash and which was kind of watching it now was kind of hilarious to me, watching two old guys fight like that.
Well, and even in the edit where they both crash, as they're about to crash and they're both screaming and you get a shot of each of them. I mean, they both look like Muppets, like, and I laughed. Like, I was like, oh, like I was just laughing because of the visual alone. Cause there was something about it. It was so animated and big that
it's hard not to find humor in kind of the choreography of that scene and what's going on.
Yeah. The not Zell's brother, but the other guy is just so like kind of over the top.
He's a big, big character. So
like I would have ratcheted him down like one or two notches, you know.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, the fact that Zell's brother drives away and then he's like, no, fuck that. I'm going after you. And like, is like, I'm going to make it a point to ride your ass. And, you know, it's a lot.
He's almost the bad guy in the scene. Like he runs that red light, you know, like through oncoming traffic. And like, he's the one who's, I don't know, like watching it this time, it came across like that. He's more of the villain in that scene. He's the aggressor.
He saw a Nazi. He had to punch him, you know, and it's like, and I think that's kind of the thing that we see as we're going from watching these 70s films, that there's so much like, so many things that were omnipresent out of the time that informed what we saw on the screen, that we lose, like just as time goes on, those things are eroded. And so it takes that extra beat. And that doesn't mean to say that makes the movie suddenly better because here's more context, but context does matter. And so choices can be more understandable regardless if they're like, maybe they lose that time, they lose a timeless quality, they don't have, or they lack a timeless quality. So that's probably why it's important that like these movies just can't exist in them. And well, I just watched it, I thought it was all right. Like there's so much context that can help inform what's going on at the time. So I mean, yeah, in 76, I mean, we're only less than 40 years removed from the end of the war. I mean, or a little more than 40 years rather. And so, I mean,
30 years, right?
30. Oh, right. I'm sorry. Jeez. Yeah,
30 years.
I'm thinking 86 in my head while I'm saying.
Well, there's so many, you know, at this point, there's so many survivors, you know, from World War II that are still around now. I mean, I don't know how many there are, but there's really not a lot left. So,
And they would have had to have been at like the smallest children, like more or less.
Right.
I mean, so yeah, it's, it's interesting to look at it now through this lens as the first time. Like, oh, like this is a movie about something that needs a different amount of attention today than it would back then.
Yeah. I don't even know if it's a movie about something, but it's a movie that
yeah,
harbors, you know, is driven by some of that for sure. And if yeah, you know, you are, you know, 60 years past it, it's not on the forefront of yeah, people's minds the way it was, you know, in the 70s.
Yeah.
I don't think this film is trying to say something on a bigger scale. No. I think it's really just there's no bigger message for this movie. It's really right, like, you know, Babe's context, sort of journey and what's happening to him really is what yeah, it ends up being about.
And maybe that's another thing that kind of bumps me, is I feel like maybe if it was made today, it would be about something bigger.
Very likely.
And so yeah, like that, maybe that's the expectation that I'm like wrestling with a little bit, that it's with opportunity, but like doesn't really, like it's just like kind of a bit of a red herring.
Is it safe?
I don't know what you mean.
I can't tell you if something is safe or not unless I know specifically what you're talking about.
I fit for me though, like all of that being said, I enjoyed their performances and the characters so much that especially once you get past that first 45 minutes that like I could like kind of, I know all that stuff is there. It didn't really bother me overall. Like I still enjoy the movie because these scenes are so intense and these characters are so, you know, so incredibly performed that I could just keep watching them. But
yeah.
So I want to ask about that. So like, I agree that, I mean, I think some of the acting in this is really good. Like, and I don't want to, you know, like, I think Dustin Hoffman probably gets credit for this being a good performance. But for me, like, I felt like his performance in this was all relatively kind of one note, you know, like.
Well, sure. But that's, I mean, what else would you expect for what that character is going through? They're just like plummeting down this, you know. Yeah, but not spiraling like
not at the beginning. I mean, I don't know, like something that stuck out of me at the beginning, like early in the scene, you know, he goes into his professor's, you know, classroom or whatever. Yeah. And he's pitching his thesis and all this. And like, you know, I get the Dustin Hoffman's method, but like he's sitting there like heaving and breathing, like he just ran across the campus, which I'm sure he probably did in real yes, life right before he sat down. But it's just so like, it's already agonizing. Like just watching him like portray that in such dramatic fashion, I'm like, okay. So then when we get to the part where he's like actually in the scenes of agony, like it didn't land as hard for me because I was like, dude, he's been like at this level the entire time, even though like when he's running through Central Park and he's like, I mean, it's like he's running from getting chased from a bear or running towards, you know, it's just like, dude, okay. Like, why is the intensity notched up so high in these early scenes? I know we're going to get there and we have a right to get there because the things that are going on are fucking intense, but like the earlier stuff, like, I don't know. It just seemed over the top to me in those moments. And so, well, like, I don't know, like, not that he didn't perform great in those really intense scenes, but like the scenes that you would expect to be less intense, he also seemed really intense. And it was like, okay, so he's just intense. And it's, I don't know, it's a little exhausting.
Well, that's his style. That's the, and that was one thing I was curious about how that aged for you guys, because Dustin Hoffman is like, there's a lot of actors that do that. Like Dustin Hoffman is, you know, once he got out of the 60s, really, he became Dustin Hoffman. You know, it's Dustin Hoffman sure, in this situation, right? And that this is what he does. He's very intense. We'll talk about the method acting in a second, but you know, that would happen to Al Pacino, that would happen to Jack Nicholson. There's a lot of actors, I think De Niro's in that, that like they settle into like what their thing is. And it just becomes, you know, them in that situation. It's harder to see them as that character. So yeah. I was curious to see how you guys would feel about Hoffman here. I think that's going to probably, looking back at a lot of his films, that's going to come up more and more often. I think that's going to bump people as his way of doing that. And
I don't know. Hmm. I mean, Tootsie, like, I don't know. It doesn't bother me in Hook, but it like really got me here, man.
Let's not talk about Hook.
John rolls his eyes. Well, one can see this.
His performance in Hook is like Jack Nicholson in Batman. You know, it's meant to be very over the top and characterized. So sure. when they're playing like more of regular type people.
I was joking by throwing Hook out there just so I could see the eye roll. But yeah, I don't know. Like, I guess I just it never really stood out to me in other movies. But to be fair, I mean, I don't even know the last time I've gone back and watched a lot of his performances.
Yeah.
You know, and I guess I knew that the super intense stuff was coming. And so seeing him play intense early just by sitting in a classroom, I was like, where are we going with this? Because this is already a lot, man.
Yeah. Like, if we're watching a movie that's just about like just the first half of this movie, I'm like not interested in following Babe.
Right. Yeah.
I'm much more interested in Doc and Zell, you know, but
yeah, for sure.
But Hoffman in a lot of his films surrounds himself with great writers and great directors and other great actors that can kind of like absorb some of that Hoffman-ness. And once he finally starts crossing paths with the other characters, I think that starts to ease up for us. But there's a lot of other stuff tonally that I like about this film. I love visually that kind of that Conrad Hall was the director of photography and the beautiful kind of saturated lighting style that he uses. I mean, the camera placement is actually very straightforward, and I kind of appreciate that in this film, that we're just like, let's just watch these actors do their thing and we don't need crazy camera moves. And and you know, the music by Michael Small, I think that score just really adding to that bleak undertone, that kind of depressing like downer 70s movie, that those are all things that contribute to that.
Is it safe?
Tell me what it refers to.
And I think, you know, going back to the Hitchcockian element of it, that, you know, we keep going, like the bathtub scene, the Doc getting attacked in the hotel room, the, you know, confrontation between Doc and Zell, obviously the dentistry torture scene, the scene at the house, the country house, and then the finale, like, are all feel very much inspired by Hitchcock. And I think Schlesinger was very open about that like, yeah, there's an element purposely put there,
which makes sense. I mean, if you think about it, at the time, like, Hitchcock is you know, one of the top in the game at being able to establish that kind of suspense.
Yeah,
I mean, it's a little bit past his prime, but like, I mean,
oh yeah.
Yeah.
He was, I think he was done by this point. I think he passes away in 79.
Yeah. I was trying to think when the Alfred Hitchcock Presents stuff was coming out, but that was
I think
directly
in the 60s.
Related to him. Yeah.
Yeah. And I like the theme overall of endurance, that, you know, it's about Babe. He's running away from confrontation. That's what that represents, is that, you know, the what happened with his father and the McCarthyism and his father's suicide, that he has been running away from, you know, that's sort of a separate thing just to really inform the character. You're right. It doesn't really come back plot wise other than the handgun itself. But you know, in general, it sets him on this path of like running away from confrontation, and that's what, you know, he's never really able to confront something like Chase in the first scene where he's running around Central Park, and that other jogger, a marathon runner, he just like can't catch up to him. And the guy like gives him the finger and keeps going. But you know, that's like, and by the end, you know, where his character is gone is that now he can turn around and he confronts, you know, has the final confrontation with Zell. And that I think is meant to show the, you know, how that character has progressed.
Yeah, he could have kept running in the end. He could have gotten away. Is it, Zell's not a formidable opponent unless
he's not going to be running after you.
Yeah. But
although little blade thing is pretty cool, but that's not going to get you.
Well, and I like it's just the thing, like there's that whole cultural undertone of Jewishness in America in 76, right? But then Babe needs something of like, well, how did he get to today? And okay, so he's some of that trauma with his father and then his relationship with his brother, but he is not living a life that has anything to do with all this other stuff. Like, he's so out of his depth once he's brought into it that he's brought in, and his brother is killed, or he dies in front of him, right? And then he has to, that panic of them breaking into the bathroom, I mean, that was great. That was like, it ratcheted up all the intensity immediately for him. And then
he's so helpless. Like, he's, you know, he's alone, naked
in a bathroom. I mean, it's just like, is there any, like, what do you do? And you can't get out, and they're in the dark. Like, so yeah, it's almost like you only just get a little piece to color his character. You need a little something. Otherwise he's a blank slate. We could all project ourselves onto the character and all that, but that's not interesting. You want to give him something, right? But most of these thrillers it seems like it features at least someone who's competent in whatever they're doing, and they're living their life, and then suddenly these just unbelievable forces crash into that character, and they have to figure out a way to survive or get through it and all that. And so, I mean, it does, his history doesn't have to play, but I think throwing away the gun and at the end, and like you said, John, the confrontation, it's like his arc is complete, like from who he was until 2 days prior, you know, like,
right.
Yeah.
He becomes a totally different character. So it is a nice little quick poetry, because without that backstory, I didn't need more of that, because it's stuff that happened to him as a child. It's just what his,
yeah, what, I mean,
who he is today, you know?
And that's, I mean, that's a fair point. I think for me, like, the McCarthyism thing and the whole flashback deal is just like at the beginning where it's the seed is planted. Like, it seems like it's another missed opportunity to connect dots to something. Whereas, like, you know, I think obviously we know Nazis are bad, but we're talking about a time where everybody in the U.S. is having trouble with trusting government, and there's this paranoia and things like that. And so I think it works as a way to show that evils can come from other places than just the Nazis in this story, right?
Oh, yeah.
But, like, it doesn't, like, you know, like, it doesn't really do that. Like, it just kind of fades away. And yeah, to your point, like, okay, they tie the bow on it, and maybe they connect it with, like, the throwing of the gun, and that seems fine. But I don't feel like they actually use it to show, like, the evil of the government versus Zell in this story, you know, because I just don't think they really get into what the government's involvement is in any of this. Like, it's all really, like, uber vague, which may have been intentional, but also
it is a little easy, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, they're not the CIA. It's the division. If you know, the CIA was bad.
Yeah.
There's this whole other thing you never heard of called the division.
So like, you know, I mean, that's all I'm saying. Like, at the beginning, it seems like it's, oh God, they're setting up all these really interesting things. There's three different stories. I mean, how many times are there a bunch of movies, especially in thrillers, have to take that time to set up three different things, because you know, at some point it's all going to come together, and that's going to reveal the outcome in the finale where, you know, you get past the suspense and you get your resolution. But like in this, they plant all the seeds and they have all this different stuff. And like, really, it doesn't lead to anything.
I think
that's my biggest takeaway. Like, that's my biggest like gripe, I think.
I think you could, or, you know, in hindsight, you could probably have had a connection between the McCarthy hearings and what was done to their father, right? And now what the division / the government is doing to Doc and Babe, right? You could draw a parallel that it's literally driving them to their deaths.
Yeah, you can, because you have to draw that parallel, right? Because they don't really give you that parallel. You're just like, I need to make this make sense, so I'm going to say this so that it connects, you know? And it's like,
yeah, totally.
You know, that's it. That's, again, moment to moment, there's like incredible things like happening in the second half of this thing, but the beginning is just like kind of a mess.
Yeah. I think like a modern filmmaker would, like, he comes home to his apartment at the end of the movie and the door is fixed on his bathroom and there's a note that just says the division thanks you. And he's got to be like, and then credits, like, oh Jesus.
Yeah, does
it have to be this overt, like, we're still watching you. Like,
yeah for sure.
let's talk about Roy Scheider for a sec. Cause I think Roy Scheider is so underrated as an actor. I think he's underappreciated for, you know, he's in so many great films from, especially from the 70s, whether it's French Connection, Jaws, this, All That Jazz, Sorcerer, you know, it goes, the Seven Ups, like it goes on and on. And he's one of those actors that he was always, you know, great. And I think he's perfect casting for the Doc role, that believable in Babe's eyes, totally believable as this just rich kind of oil man, businessman. And then we see the reality of it. Like, no, he's a spy and, you know, can handle himself in the action scenes and also in the dramatic scenes with, you know, confronting Zell. Did you catch the relationship between Doc and Janeway?
They're not best friends?
Well, in the book, book, they're a lot more explicit about that. I was reading about that. That like in the book, they're like in a relationship. They're like partners. Oh.
Well, and it's very subtle in the movie, but
super subtle.
Doc gets to the hotel.
One look.
Well, when Doc gets to the hotel, he calls Janie and telling him, I mean, it's like he's talking to his girlfriend, like telling to get his ass
over
there.
I didn't even pick up on that.
That's
Janie.
Janie is Janeway.
Oh, hell.
So, and that's all there is, you know, and then just, like a look in the.
I just knew the one look, but I didn't pick up on the Janie, but that's valid.
In the
book, apparently it's much more explicit. Like it's,
oh yeah, no, they're like in love with each other, I think, in the book.
Janie betrayed him.
Exactly. Oh. And William Devane, great performance. You know, we talked about him in our Rolling Thunder episode. You can dig that out in the archives at reconsideration.com. Another great actor who, you know, he still pops up kind of here and there. He's still around.
Sure.
Always good. Very good in 24.
Loved him in
24. Remembers that show.
I like that show.
Which season was he in of 24?
Few different ones. He kind of comes and goes.
Yeah, the last thing I remember seeing him in was Interstellar, I think.
You know Interstellar?
Yeah.
That was Matthew McConaughey.
That movie? Yeah, you're right.
And Matt Damon, too, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, they're both in it, but so is William Devane.
No, that's John Lithgow. You're thinking of the wrong guy.
Okay, sure.
I'm making jokes.
You got them. You got all the jokes.
I remember when I saw this the first time, when after he's violently killed, and he's not killed right away. You know, he gets gutted, really, by Zell. And that's a just really intense scene. And so you could feel the pain because he's not even yelling. Like he's just gasping.
Just gargling. Like,
yeah.
Is that the reveal of the knife?
Yeah.
Of the wrist blade?
Yeah, that's the, you see him put the, when he's on the airplane, Zell, you see him like putting on that metal like cufflink.
Yeah.
But
that's the first time you see it in action.
Yeah.
And they don't even, they kind of hide it there, right?
Yeah. Well, you don't actually see the blade. I mean, you just know he stabbed him with something.
Yeah. But you don't see the, I don't think you see the blade fully until he slices that dude's neck in the street. Like,
right. Right.
During the other scene, and you're like, oh, damn.
Yeah.
Baraka.
There's three scenes with it. When he kills Doc, when he kills the guy in the street, and then at the very end when he falls on it.
Yeah.
I was always so heartbroken, though, that, like, that's Martin Brody. Just killed Martin Brody.
Yeah, you'd think he would have been able to do something about it, you know? The fact that he got caught so unawares is...
It's rough. Surprising it was hard that, like, he wasn't, you know, expecting something like that to happen. I mean, he's already walking into a meeting where he's outnumbered. He has no backup.
Yeah.
Which is also, like, what is Janeway doing? Like, how much does the division actually even know what's going on here?
Right.
Well, and, like, all these bad guys dealing with each other, like, there's a... It's about mutual... like destruction, right? Like it would be unlikely that they would betray and kill one another because they're both trying to gain something. So it's a big power move for Zell to do that. So it's, I mean, I can kind of get it, but you know, sometimes people are caught unaware.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I don't think anybody expects some 80-year-old dude to be having like a freaking James Bond gadget knife on his wrist. I'm pretty sure.
Well, that's where, you know, that's where you find out like how bad this guy is. Like how lethal he is.
Is it safe?
Yes, it's safe. It's very safe. It's so safe you wouldn't believe it.
Yeah. I think, man, the looks on his face during this the dentist scene are incredible.
Like, Laurence Olivier is so incredible in this role. He transforms his face almost. It's an amazing performance, and
he's acting.
Exactly. Acting. Yeah.
Showing Dustin Hoffman how to act.
Yeah. Well, that's So whoever doesn't know that story, we'll tell it here. That during that scene, Laurence Olivier and Dustin Hoffman came from two very different schools of acting. Yes. Laurence Olivier was classically trained, theatrical actor. He's all about the sticking to the script and you know, really knowing his performance. Dustin Hoffman came up as a method actor and like lives the performance. He becomes the character and, you know, 24/7. And he was running laps around the building, you know, the stage where they were shooting it, so that, and he stayed up for days.
Hadn't
like 3 days straight.
Hadn't showered. Just was a mess.
So when they're, you know, in the middle of shooting this scene, and Hoffman's having a hard time, Laurence Olivier just turns to John Schlesinger, the director, and just says, "Has he tried acting?"
Yeah,
like, brilliant.
There is something to that, though, because like, is method acting really as artistic as what like you're trying to do? Because it seems just more like a psychological exercise for the actor and nobody else.
It is, but if acting
it's miserable for the crew, I can tell you that much. You have to, you know, kind of deal with that.
Maybe. I mean, I believe that is fact, but I also think, like, I don't want to discredit method, because how many amazing performances have we gotten? Because, I mean, think about it. Like, acting is about a performance. How you get to that spot is the argument, right? But, like, there's so many incredibly talented actors who are method, who give some of the greatest performances. Yeah. But that sounds like torture. Like, not torture for the people around them, for sure. Like, you know, you hear the stories of having to, like, refer to the person by the character's name throughout shooting and all sorts of stuff, you know, like, not to mention like just if they're playing a shithead of a person, which in most cases they are, they're just treating the people around them like shitheads too. But I think as the performer, having to live your life as someone else has also got to be incredibly like painful and difficult. And I'm also curious if that extends all the way back to the house, like they're living at home, you know, like with their wife. And because I know some actors will like rent, like they'll totally detach themselves from their people and just live like secluded or surrounded by people who help sell this ideal. But man, I couldn't even screw that.
Yeah. And on the other hand, like you have Olivier who can get this kind of a performance without having to do all that.
Yeah.
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 But the other thing that's like really terrifying to me is that there was a lot of people exactly like this in real life. You know, these guys that, you know, that character was based on Joseph Mengele, who was, you know, the white angel. And obviously there's so many horrible things that came out of the Holocaust and all of that, and just the worst of people, what you could do to another human. It's horrifying, but
absolutely.
Yep. The darkness of people when they have the power and permission to do horrific things. And that's why that ending was so satisfying to me. It's like, you got him good. Like, you tortured him too by throwing the diamonds. Like, you know, he just,
well, and he didn't even get him right. Like he got himself, he engineered it in a way that he get, like Zell got himself.
Yeah, true. Yeah.
You know what I mean? So which I think is even like more poetic, but
yeah.
I like it too. There was a lot of discussion, you know, during the writing phase of how they're going to handle that. Like, is the audience going to feel satisfied enough? Cause I think of the book, he just, you know, Babe just gets him down there and then shoots him and kills him. And that's it.
That wouldn't have been as satisfying.
No. Yeah, I like the elaborate way it's kind of dragged out, and that he just kind of forces him into killing himself, really.
Yeah, like tries to make him eat his diamonds.
Well, just, if he ate all, like, I mean, they would tear his insides up, so he would.
That's my assumption. Yeah, yeah, like especially if he ate, you know, however many. I mean, he had
one
thousands of diamonds there. Like, for sure.
And just like as he threw the handfuls away at him, like just that, you know, that's each diamond was $15,000.
Yeah.
And that's like, those represented his life, Zell's life, really, that's what he was going to live on the rest of his life. And just throwing those away so casually, it was great.
Yeah. I'm not going to lie. Young me, who was infatuated with like, you know, like, treasure, the thought of treasure hunting and like big, you know, lockers of like gold doubloons and diamonds and rubies, I was like, oh man, all those diamonds look super cool. And I was like, don't throw them in the water, go get them.
Yeah, because you know, like no one's probably ever gonna find those.
Yeah, I mean,
maybe that janitor, not janitor guy, but the you know, the worker who was in there, maybe.
Well, let's think about that for a second, because so that was a sewage system, right?
I think so.
Like a drainage system. Like so that's like gray water that eventually wouldn't that find its way to some sort of water plant of some sort? Yeah. And if that's the case, they'd probably all end up in a filter of some sort. And there's going to be the one guy, Ralph, who's like cleaning the filter one day. And he's like, Billy, come here.
We get the jackpot.
Yeah.
And then the division's going to go after those guys. So, yeah, it looks like
the division have no idea where the diamonds are at this point.
Truth be told, that's how we financed Recon Cinema Studios.
We got some diamonds.
We got some of those diamonds. It came out of my sink, really. It was crazy.
Just overflowing.
not safe. It's very dangerous. Be careful.
Going back to Janeway for a second, I think part of what he represents in the movie is capitalism. That, you know, mm-hmm. not he doesn't really care about any of the people involved. He just is all about getting ahead and getting what they need. He needs to be successful.
Yeah, at whatever cost.
At whatever cost. He doesn't care. You know, it's big business. That he may be in a relationship with Doc, but ultimately it was more important to the diamonds were more important than
yeah, Doc. Or whatever human cost. I should
yeah
probably yeah. clarify.
Yep. Yeah, so I kind of like that symbolism, and I like that. Yes, there are for sure there's plot holes about the division and what they're really doing, but I think they were doing it that way to make it scarier that, you know, 2 years or, you know, what was it, 4 years post Nixon, 2 years
yeah.
post Nixon, post Watergate, mm-hmm. that there's so much distrust of the government and fear yeah, sure. about what they were actually doing. So it's really, you may not play well, as well now, but then it was like really, all these films are really hitting that nerve.
Yeah. Well, and the thing is like, I've been bagging on it, you know, the back end really is super well done and like great to watch, like riveting, I think is a good way to put it. With the front end, like, I just feel like it's disconnected. Right. So, and I don't think it would have taken all that much to connect it. It just seems like they did. There was like, well, we're just not going to do that. Like it wasn't important. There's like, we're just not going to do that. And, you know, but I think that it's not like so flawed that it couldn't have been fixed, you know, like it's just like an extra line here or an extra shot there. But, yeah. but in the grand scheme of the whole thing, when you watch it, it does feel really disjointed and kind of incomplete and just like, okay, well, all right, let's just ignore that and enjoy the last half here.
Is I didn't realize it was a book. It was the book written pretty like immediate, like, was this a recent book? And then
yeah.
I'm assuming it's a little more robust about these themes or anything like that. I mean, I don't know if you've read it, John, or
I haven't read the book, but the William Goldman wrote the book in 1974. So it went, you know, from the book like straight into the movie. And I guess we'll talk a little bit about that now. He was paid $500,000, which is probably close to $3 million now.
Ooh, yeah.
By Paramount, that bought Paramount with that money bought the rights to the novel, and that included his fee for becoming the screenwriter.
And he was well established at this point, right? Like, I mean, he had written a couple things that were already super successful.
Yeah. Butch Cassidy was, you know, Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid was probably, you know, his biggest claim to fame at the time. Yeah. And we actually recently in our Princess Bride episode, check that out in the archives, talked a lot about William Goldman too. He had already by this point actually written The Princess Bride and was shopping it around for, you know, 9 years. But,
wow.
So that's kind of happening simultaneously. A movie that is couldn't be more opposite in every way than this one. But he did a tremendous amount of script work, you know, some of it credited, some of it not. He was probably considered, you know, one of the top five screenwriters, if not top three screenwriters of the day. Yeah, I think a lot of this stuff, you know, he was doing to his own script. Him and Schlesinger worked together to figure out what was going to translate and what wasn't. I'm not surprised that they really toned down the Janeway Doc relationship.
Yeah, it seemed like adding an extra complication to things that they already weren't explaining.
Right.
So, like,
yeah,
why?
I think it works. You know, it's like if you caught it, it's still in there. If you didn't catch it, it's fine.
Yeah.
But yeah, and I think, you know, they were kind of tailoring some of this to the performers that they were casting. That Schlesinger is coming off of a film called The Day of the Locusts, which I'm sure you guys have not seen. I have, and it's a kind of a bananas movie. And
it's like a beat down on Hollywood, right? Like, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah, very much so.
Yeah.
And Schlesinger was really almost more of an avant-garde kind of filmmaker. If you watch, he had done Midnight Cowboy in 1969, also with Dustin Hoffman. And if you've seen that film, it's very, it was the beginning of the Hollywood New Wave, but it's very stylistic and very different. It's not a very straightforward film that it feels almost like a, you know, independent film. But so he was so worried of where his standing was going to be after Day of the Locusts. He thought he was going to get, you know, just totally like booted out of Hollywood. So he's like, yeah, yeah, I'll do it. I'll do Marathon Man. Yep, let's go right now.
Huh.
So
smart move.
take
it quick.
It's like Walter Hill when he did The Warriors after The Driver, knowing that The Driver was going to tank. He's like, let's get Warriors going before they take that movie away from me. So,
is it true that how do you say his name?
Schlesinger.
Is it true he did not want Dustin Hoffman in this?
Yeah, I think partially for the reasons we talked about, that, you know,
it's funny, he worked with him on Midnight Cowboy and he's like, I don't want to work with that guy again.
Yeah, no, I don't think it was that he didn't want to work with Hoffman. I think he didn't feel that Hoffman was really the best suited for this part, and Hoffman just lobbied and lobbied and lobbied, and I think
the 50-year-old college kid.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's 38 years old playing, you know, what, 24 maybe.
Yeah, he does not look 38, man. He looks,
yeah,
everybody smoked back then, yeah.
Yeah, he looks weathered.
Yeah.
Roy Scheider was a leathery kind of guy forever.
Always.
Wasn't he?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, he was only 32 in this. So.
Was he really?
Sorry. That's,
I mean, like, I, what? Total, that can't be.
It's totally hyperbole, but I'm just.
That'd be hilarious.
Making a joke.
Yeah. Hoffman was like, what, at this point, though, was one of the biggest stars in the business. You know, leading up to this, listen to this lineup of films leading up to this one. The Graduate, Midnight Cowboy, Little Big Man, Straw Dogs, Papillon, Lenny, and All the President's Men.
No Tootsie yet, though.
No Tootsie yet.
Not yet.
But
it's coming.
But you kind of forget like how big he was. Like, those were, you know, all well-respected movies that I think they were all financial hits. I'm not sure if every one of them was, but certainly All the President's Men, I think, came out just a few months before this one. So he's still staying in that political world. I think he knew that was, you know, a kind of a good spot for him to land.
Yeah.
Yeah. He played a character in my first movie at DreamWorks called Shifu in Kung Fu Panda. And it's always interesting when method actors try to do voice acting, because, you know, it's out of the box for them. So he was an interesting record. He was not as interesting as Larry Sanders, who played a character named Vern in Over the Hedge, which was a turtle, and he would literally take a trash can and put it over his head and act as if he was in a turtle shell. So that was, yeah, interesting. But yeah, all right. Good old method.
How would a method actor do a voice character of a, what was he, a rabbit?
A red panda.
He was a red panda.
Yeah. So took a minute for him to find his groove.
Yeah,
for sure.
I'm sure. And that would, like, that method, you know, he would continue doing that method style, you know, at least all the way into the early 90s. You know, he was, you know, there's famous stories from Tootsie, from Rain Man, that, you know, there, I think even like Dick Tracy, you know, he was still doing it there. And I know for sure on Wag the Dog, which was way in 97, that it was still, you know, a thing that he was doing. So
yeah,
but it's it's a balance that you know, hopefully you get this great performance without it being just kind of a nightmare to deal with, that you can kind of keep it at bay. I think it's really hard for a lot of actors to do both.
Yeah.
We talked about Roy Scheider and kind of everything he was in. Laurence Olivier was, again, at this point, was probably considered the greatest living actor. You know, all the Shakespearean films and all the theater he had done, that he was, you know, I think when we were kind of growing up, you know, high school, college years, it was like De Niro, Pacino were considered the greatest living actors of that era.
Like Keanu Reeves now.
Like, yeah, right. Keanu now, for sure.
Or Nick Cage.
Be both. Yeah. but Olivier was that prior to those guys. So, and he was in and out of this movie in the very beginning, that he was going to do it, but he was really, he had been sick for a long time and wasn't well enough to do it. So they replaced him with Richard Widmark, who is another, you know, actor from 40s, 50s and 60s, great performer. And Schlesinger said that was like one of the most chilling rehearsals that he'd seen, that like was legitimately scared him in the rehearsals. But then Olivier got better and was like, no, I'm good, I can go. So they brought him back.
I can't imagine. I mean, he's so good at the role. I can't imagine what Wedmark must have done.
Yeah, you know? I don't know. I wish we'd been able to see it. But but this, to me, this is like, I don't, it's like an iconic villain role. It's so evil that, it, you know, it's not talked about enough, but it's just like, this is really a performance for actors to study, I think.
Are you to be trusted?
No.
Is that the truth? Are you trying again to upset me?
I know that you're going to the bank sooner or later.
Perhaps I've already been.
If you had, you wouldn't be here talking to me, would you?
What else do you know?
I know that you're panicking. You think when you leave the bank, someone's going to rob you.
Who would do such a thing?
Obviously, you think I would.
Well, can I trust you?
You never could. You only had to.
We're talking of my safety.
May I be candid?
Yes.
I couldn't give a fuck about you.
Yeah, yes. Yeah, it's powerful. I mean, he is... Well, because also, like, he has moments of, like, kind of natural human reactions. Like when he's like, I don't know, like when he's realizing how many diamonds he has and he's kind of like chipper and giddy and kind of, you know, this whole like kind of a natural human reaction. But then you see the scenes where he's like, you know, evil and you're like, fuck, dude. Like,
yeah.
This guy is dark.
Yeah. And it starts really when he stabs, the minute he stabs Doc is the turn.
Yeah, I mean, you don't really see it at all up to that point. Like, you can see that he's obsessive about things as he's like, you know, like he's like shaving his head to give him the kind of the monk or the horseshoe hair look and all that stuff. Like, you can tell that he's like, yeah, like fully committed to whatever he's doing at the time. But like, yeah, you don't see that side of him until that moment. And I think you really, it's really on display in the torture scene.
Yeah. And let's talk about that scene. It's a very difficult scene to watch, especially I think like that did for dentistry what Jaws did for beaches.
Sure.
Like people just stopped going to the dentist.
Well, apparently they cut it down a lot too, which I don't know if it would have been as bad or worse, you know, because sometimes by not showing things, it's the sound of the drill, man, and the look in his eyes. And it's just like
all of them. It's Hoffman's reaction. It's, you know, he's like that first when Zell first walks in the room and just is simply asking, is it safe? And you know, man. Hoffman has
no idea
what he's talking about. So whatever answer he gives is the wrong answer.
Yeah.
Because if he says, you know, if he says yes, then it just either way, like he's screwed. And as Zell kind of just like explains, you know, sort of what he's going to do.
Yeah, he never actually tells him what information he wants. He just says, is it safe? Is it safe?
Right.
Like,
right.
Also, why can't you just ask, where are my diamonds, dude? You know, like.
Right.
Because they all think, think that he knows more than he does. Because when they assume.
They don't ask him the fucking questions.
Well. But Janeway does. Janeway asks him, like, what did Doc tell you? They think that when Doc got back to his apartment and dies in Babe's arms, they think that he told him something. We know as an audience he didn't, because he couldn't even say Babe. Like, he didn't say anything. Yeah. But
but they're asking the question as if he has the information. He doesn't have the information, so they're making an assumption. So they're not really asking him the question. They're just saying, right. What did he say?
Yeah.
Well, he said nothing. Well, we don't believe you.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, okay. This is a paradox. Like, hey, where did he tell you the diamonds are? What fucking diamonds?
Yeah.
Like, this guy's not like a trained... Like, you know,
Well, that's why
he's a big nerd.
He's not trained in like counterintelligence where, you know, I mean, it's like, yeah.
Well, that's how
the scene's great, but it's like, what the fuck? It's just another kind of one of those, like, well, come on, guys. Like,
yeah, be reasonable here.
So,
yeah.
William Goldman, when writing that scene, actually, part of that came from his own experience as a kid, that he had a dentist that didn't use, as he was, you know, a kid in what, the 40s or something, or 1950, early 50s. He had a dentist that didn't use Novocaine and would, when he would work on his mouth, would like just plant his knee like in William Goldman's like stomach so he couldn't move. Mm. So a lot of this came from, yeah.
Did he come from Germany?
I don't know. So it came from that. And then he consulted with his, you know, present day dentist and said, who kind of said, like, you know, drilling into the nerve of a tooth without Novocaine is one of the most, is the most painful thing you could do to somebody, because those nerves are so sensitive.
Dude,
that.
I had a cracked tooth once and the nerve got infected. And I was flying on a plane, and as we were landing, the pressure change, like, basically irritated the thing. And literally there were spikes of pain going from like the back of my head, like down my face, into my chest. Like, it was the most brutal pain I've ever felt in my life. It was horrible. It's terrible.
Yeah.
Oh.
So that's how they know, you know, Zell knows that, like, if he knew, he would have told.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. No one's holding on for diamonds for that amount of pain.
And the scene, you know, immediately following that, where Janeway shows up and it's like, you know, he's rescuing him. And then that turn, the reveal of that turn where, you know, he's like, you think he's driving away. And he's like, he's also trying to get Babe to tell him what Doc said. And then you realize, like, oh no, he just drove him right back there. He's with them. He's one of them.
Yeah. Oh, that's the worst. I was like, oh.
Like, no. How the hell is this
it's
guy
a fake
gonna get
blade.
Away?
Blanks, fake blade.
Yeah. Right, right,
okay.
Right.
Yeah, a little hokey there, but
yeah.
Well, that switchblade was not a fake one. I mean, like, that was a heavy duty looking thing. I know. Just the.
But then we see the marathon running come back into play again. That's how he escapes, and he's able to just keep running. Like, even as much pain and as awful as he's feeling, like, instinctually he can run, and he can outrun this guy, and he can keep going.
Well, and marathon runners train to run through pain, right? Like, I mean, that's the whole thing.
Says I don't feel it. I just go.
Yeah.
Or whatever. And I realize, I think the Simpsons parodied his running. I could have sworn, I was like, I've seen Homer Simpson in pajama bottoms and a robe and running with the absolute manic look on his face down the street. I'm like, I've definitely, and I haven't watched The Simpsons in like 20 years, but like, I'm like, I know that scene. Like, I have seen that. But this is a movie ripe for a lot of references in pop culture. But anyway, yeah, that was that was so intense. I was like, oh, he's a marathon man. He's gonna go, like, he can run forever. They're never gonna get him. It was really thrilling, that part. And then Janeway comes to save the day, only to betray him. My heart was just dropping.
There's prior to that, just going back to Roy Scheider for a second, there's that one moment after, you know, when he leaves the opera and, you know, his contact there has been killed, and he's like kind of in those, not tunnels, but those like exterior hallways where he's trying to meet up. He's supposed to meet up with Nicole, and he says, it's not safe. It's keep going. It's not safe. And she walks into the shadows, and you just hear this sound, and she just disappears. And then that soccer ball kind of, comes bouncing into frame slowly. And like, I don't know what that represented, but like, that was just such a creepy moment. Like, what happened to her? Like, did someone just kill her? And I don't know, like, I think we've all had that experience of like being in the shadows at night and like hearing something and imagination going. And
it reminded me of a scene in the movie The Changeling with George C. Scott, where there's this haunted house and there's this red ball that just like bounces down that comes out of the shadows and just bounces down the stairs, and you're just like, oh, it's very uneasy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Did in this movie, did the killers buy a soccer ball earlier in the day? And then they were like, all right, we're going to get it. And then
you should have seen that scene.
That should have been set up in the beginning. We should have seen him running by a sports store. And there's a guy in a suit. This guy in a suit.
Yeah, the two guys, ball. The two thugs that were Richard Bright and Mark Lawrence. Yeah.
Yeah. Which, those guys.
Yeah, Richard Bright plays Al Neary in the Godfather films, one of my favorite characters.
Yeah, a nice supporting cast of villains through in this film as well.
Yeah, yeah.
That scene happened in Paris, right?
Yes, that was still in Paris. Yeah,
well, that explains it. The French, they play soccer.
Yeah,
very, very, yeah, very soccer friendly in France. Walking around. Most people walk around with soccer balls in France. We know this.
Yeah.
Especially during protests. Has France never not protests, by the way? They're always protesting.
No, right? There's always something.
There's something to protest. I mean, good for them. Anyway.
They did that because there was also like other union unrest in New York that is kind of subtly mentioned.
That's right.
They put all that in there to just create this more like, unrest, with the government.
Yeah, everything's uneasy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Instability everywhere.
I also like the hotel attack on Doc that was done by the Key Luke, I think is his name.
Yeah. Odd Job Light.
From Gremlins. He's the owner of
It felt very James Bond to me, that scene.
Oh, totally.
Like the fight scene.
Oh yeah.
In the hotel room, I was like,
yeah, he's whipping that Garrett around or whatever you call it.
But that cut on his hand.
Brutal.
Yeah. Like, you could almost feel that, like how painful, if you cut your hand, like, anywhere that.
A lot of visceral moments in the film that you can kind of just, that's this, as we're talking about some of them, I'm just shivering in my spine.
It's that gritty 70s films.
70s.
Grainy
film
stock. You got, oh.
So gritty. Well,
the Steadicam. I mean, this is one of the first movies, if not the first movie to really use Steadicam.
It's the second movie.
Second.
Okay. I think Bound for Glory was first, and then this, and then Rocky.
I mean, that just adds to uneasiness and, frantic kind of imagery and it's all intentional. I get it.
You don't have to like it.
Sure.
Yeah. I don't.
But it's there.
I mean, again, the second half is, you know, like, I'm going to lean into the second half of this.
Hell yeah. Oh, I'm with
you. Just start the movie in 45 minutes.
Yeah.
And I want to mention Martha Keller, too. Great performance by her.
Yeah.
As, you know, how involved is she? You know, what level is she actually at with these, with Zell and the confrontation scene? You know, you know something's up. Obviously, Roy Scheider sees it right away and fools her. And so you know something's up with her. And then
but he's trained to cut through the bullshit.
Yeah. Know? Yeah. And he gets into it like right away.
Yeah. He's like, you're lying.
He makes up that whole story and that she, you know, agrees to. But all right, should we check out how this did at the box office, a little box office glory?
Let's do it.
Sure.
Roll the tape.
All right, so we know there's not a lot of box office details back prior to the early 80s, but this is what we have. Marathon Man had a $6.5 million budget.
Whoa.
It was shot in late 1975 in Paris, New York, and Los Angeles at Paramount Studios. It was released on October 8th, 1976. It had a $28.2 million domestic run. It was the number 15 movie of 1976, right between Taxi Driver and The Outlaw Josie Wales.
You see that yet?
Outlaw Josie Wales?
Yeah.
I love that film.
Oh, okay. I thought you hadn't seen that. Maybe it's another.
No, High Plains Drifter is the one I haven't seen.
That's the one.
Yeah. The top three at the box office in 1976 were Rocky, To Fly, which I've never heard of, and the Barbra Streisand, Kris Kristofferson version of A Star Is Born.
Ooh.
Dustin Hoffman also has the number six film with All the President's Men. So, I mean,
wow.
If you look at the list of films in 1976, it's really one of the greatest years in film history. You've got Rocky and Network and All the President's Men and Marathon Man and Taxi Driver and, you know, Outlaw Josie Wales. Like, there's so many great, great films from that year. This is just one of them. But yeah, what was kind of the fallout for this movie? Well, you know, it was a big deal for Laurence Olivier. His film career had kind of been winding down by this point, and this really revived it for him in his last kind of stage of his career. He gets a Best Supporting Actor nomination for this. I think the first movie I remember seeing Laurence Olivier in was Clash of the Titans, where he plays Zeus.
Oh, yeah. That's probably the first time I remember seeing him, too.
Yeah, and he looks like younger in that movie, which is 1981. You know, he did such a great job of like feeling older in this one, but
it's the hair, the white hair with the cool cut.
Yeah, the cool. It is a cool cut.
Yeah. And all the cool kids are doing it.
Yeah,
get those.
David, you got to get on the bandwagon with that haircut.
Oh, I'm definitely. I was thinking about it. I definitely need a change. I'm gonna go all white and just shave the top off.
Yeah.
Once you go cool cat, you never go back. Just be careful.
Go for the George Costanza look.
It's permanent.
Mm. I'm probably more the Bruce Willis. That's where I'm going to go.
Okay.
Just keep it one little like centimeter tall.
Yeah.
There you go.
This movie obviously is a showcase for Dustin Hoffman. It's, you know, solid showings by Roy Scheider and William Devane as well. It's got, you know, a number of iconic scenes that, you know, we all heard about growing up, and I think for rightfully so. And I think this is one of Schlesinger's masterpiece, really his masterpiece film. I think, problems aside, there's so many memorable things about it that I think you can contribute to him. So
yeah, there's a lot of iconic moments for sure, and I think you feel the influences of this movie and so much afterwards, you know?
Yeah.
So I would agree, even though I'm on the side of not quite loving this movie, like you can definitely feel its influences, which I think I said earlier. But
yeah, I think that's why, you know, this isn't one of the top 70s movies that, you know, on the whatever lists, you know, the AFI lists and all of that. You know, sometimes they'll have like greatest villains and Laurence Olivier will be in there, but as a movie as a whole, you know, it's not ranked up there with the Chinatowns, the Godfathers, the Taxi Drivers, because I think some of the disjointedness of it, and especially in that first half, are work against it, and that there is plot holes, admittedly so, but it's sort of like there's stuff that doesn't work, but there's also some great things in it that kind of counterbalance it. So ultimately, like, I enjoy watching the film. I can look past the flaws, but I know that they're there.
Yeah. There's no perfect movie.
Well, have you seen The Thing, David? Because...
But I stand
Mac,
corrected.
Mac and me? Hello.
Cocoon? We need our other Cocoon.
Oh, we didn't even talk about it. Dude.
You've watched Cocoon recently.
I finally found a copy. I bought it.
Yeah.
I own Cocoon, guys.
Nice.
We can totally review Cocoon now. I'll send it out. Everybody watch it. Listeners, too, if you're interested, you got to see this movie.
You will rent it out to our listeners. I think that's,
I will. Yeah, absolutely. Generous of you.
Yeah. Well, I'm excited to cover that on a future episode. We need Joe Setta with us, though. We need the ultimate cocoony power.
Bring everybody.
Yeah. Everybody should join in.
Everybody.
All guest stars.
But for now, I'm excited to keep, you know, to stay in this world a little bit longer and take a look at another 70s paranoid thriller. Because next week, we are going to look at Robert Redford in 3 Days of the Condor.
Ooh.
Hey, so, listeners, guess who picked that one?
David.
Guess who has scheduled this chunk of films right here?
Guess who's guess whose month it is?
I know. Not everyone loves the 70s movies. I know they're not for everybody, but, you know, we will go back there occasionally. So
I'm just bagging. I these movies are great.
These movies are great. You know, they don't make them like this anymore, probably for good reason, but they don't make them this way.
Oh,
I'm kidding.
They just copy them.
You guys are going to have fun with next week's episode. I think you guys.
No, I actually, I like that movie. So
yeah, that'll be fun.
I've seen that one. So,
and we've got a really fun lineup coming up after that. I'm not going to spoil what it is, but there are some big movies that I think we've been talking about covering for a long time. There's some anniversary years. We've got our 200th episode special, very special episode coming up for that. And as we mentioned at the top of the show, a mailbag episode. So again, hit us up on social media. We're Recon Cinemation Podcast on Instagram and Twitter or X or whatever it's called now. And, you know, you can direct message us there. Any questions, throw it out there. We'll be happy to answer anything about, you know, film from yesteryear, today, you know, Recon Cinemation. We can answer questions about that. Let's see what you got. So we're handing you the keys to the show a little bit. But quick thank you and shout out to our friends EK Wimmer for the theme music, as always, and Curtis Moore for the poster. What a lovely
love those
one
guys.
Yeah, they're the best. All right, guys. Well, I'm gonna go back to our my shadowy government job with the division where David actually is mentoring me and how the division works.
I recently recruited you. Yeah.
Yeah. Now everybody knows. So
pretty sure broadcasting that is exactly how that works, guys. Well done.
We've changed our policies a lot. It's more
your secret agency is so secret.
We're more like a private company with open recruiting.
Yeah.
Check us out on LinkedIn.com and Indeed.
Nice. All right, guys. Well, thank you very much for taking a look back at Marathon Man.
Thank you.
I recommend everyone watch it. But know what it is going into it if you haven't seen it in a long time. So,
yeah.
Yeah, same. Go watch this thing.
Watch the second half. It's awesome.
Watch the whole thing.
Just kidding. Watch the whole thing. Yeah. It's worth it.
Watch the whole thing. Yeah, it's fine. It's not totally a waste of time. Not a waste of time.
And so we're going to go from Dustin Hoffman all the way to Robert Redford next week. And we'll see you then on Reconcinimation.
Take care.
Cowabunga.
Love you, Keanu.
That's understood.
Nice.
I know, but when I started bagging on Keanu, I was like, well, if he's listening,
yeah,
he better know that, sure. I love him.
You miss home?
I bet you do.
Mint jelly, man.
What do you miss most of all?
People? The country? Skiing?
I suppose all.
I'm not really that familiar with Switzerland. What part are you from?
A tiny place.
Thank you.
Verbier.
Verbier?
Yeah.
Oh, I don't believe it.
What?
There's this guy that works in my office, a ski bum. A real pain in the ass about skiing, excuse me. But he's always going on about Verbier. That's right at the foot of Mount Rosa, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
He says it's some of the best skiing in the world. Mm. Is that true?
Of course.
Is he 100% right?
Sure.
Well, then you must know Claude Lesueur, the instructor there. Have you skied with him?
Yeah.
Where is it?
Verbier.
I've made all this up. There is no Mount Rosa in Verbier, and there is no Claude Lesueur. You're not Swiss. What are you? What are you?
Can't you guess?
Sure. German.
Anything else?
How long are your working papers good for?
Hey, wait a minute. It's a joke. It's not funny.
I don't need work papers. I'm a student here.
Je comprends. I don't know. Whatever you do.
You know, many foreigners marry Americans to make things nice and legal. Then all of a sudden the marriages don't work out.
Is that what you think of me?
Look, stop it. Just stop it, man.
Why don't you ask me if I care for him?
Why bother? You haven't told the truth so far.
But why don't you ask me if I love him? Why don't you...
Okay, wait a minute. It's all right, Elsa. Wait.
Let her go.
Why?
Because she's a phony. She's after something. Can't you see it?
Why don't you stay out of it?